Willkommen auf den Spuren alter Kulturen, dem Podcast des Marburg-Zentrums Antike Welt, in welchem wir der Frage nachgehen, wie in den Altertumswissenschaften zur Erkenntnis gelangt wird. Mein Name ist Florian und heute moderiert mit mir Adrian.
Hallo.
Ich freue mich ganz besonders auf unser Gespräch, denn unser heutiger Gast verbindet ein recht einzigartig vielfältiges Methodenspektrum in ihrer Arbeit. Und damit wechseln wir ins Englische. And to our guest, Maria del Carmen Moreno Escobar, a researcher currently at Lund University in Sweden, who combines classical archaeology, history and computer science to understand how people in the ancient Mediterranean moved, interacted and maybe also organized their landscapes. Her work ranges from identifying the ancient signaling system along the Tiber River to reinterpreting the romanization of Baetica through landscape analysis. Currently, she's working on movement and connectivity on a larger scale in a new project. Maria del Carmen, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. That was a really nice introduction and you got my name right. So that's extra points for you. I know that my name is long, complex, so I really appreciate this. I'm very happy to be here with you.
In this podcast, we always want to look at the methodology people apply to their research, but also we are very much interested in how they got there and what is their personal share, their personal view, their personal perspective on these things. Mm-hmm. So I've read that you have a very mixed training in your background. you have history, your classical archaeology, your computer science and stuff like this. And this in a consecutive order. So how did this shape your view of ancient spaces of the ancient world?
So I do archaeology, and in archaeology context is everything. So I believe there are some circumstances that help understand how I came to do what I do. So the thing is, when I was at school, I really liked history, like a lot. And so I decided to study history at the University of Seville. That's in southern Spain. My plans at the moment were like, I'm going to be the greatest teacher at high school ever. But then in the third year, I did some archaeological excavations that were compulsory in one of the modules. And I thought, oh my God, archaeology is great. And I completely fell in love with it. So then I redirected my efforts into ancient history, archaeology and prehistory. And I was completely happy and in full bliss with archaeology and archaeological excavations and so on. And when I finished my degree, my licenciatura in Spanish, I started working in commercial archaeology. And that was great. I really enjoyed that. But I also applied for funding at the Pablo de Olavide University for a PhD grant. The catch with that grant is that if I got the money, the funding, I was going to work with a bunch of geographers in a research group of geography. And then as it happened, I got the funding and I thought like, okay, so these people do a lot of geography, modern geography. I do archaeology and ancient history. So what's the middle point? And I realized that landscapes were the middle point there. They did landscapes and there is one very interesting discipline in archaeology called landscape archaeology. And I thought like, this looks promising. Let's do this. Let's explore this. And it was amazing. When you think of landscapes, what do you think? What is the images or the concept that come to your mind?
Like a view. If you're on a mountain and you look down on a view, this is probably a landscape.
It's
like
you look
down and you see, well, something.
Something. It's something that you see, something that you experience from a point of view. But the thing is that once you go into the geography literature about the concept of landscape, landscape is so much more. And then it becomes this very interesting concept that embodies the relationship between the people and the areas that they live in. They move around, they organize. And I realized that basically landscapes and territories are social constructs. Mm-hmm. And through landscapes and trying to understand the organization and the development of landscapes, you can actually understand the people that created them, that lived them, that transformed them. And I thought, like, this is a very powerful tool for trying to get a different perspective on communities and local people in the past. And I thought, like, okay, let's this is a good idea. Let's see how it works in Roman archaeology. And then I found my topic for the PhD, the Romanization of Baetica. And I thought, like, let's do this. But one thing is doing landscapes or studying landscapes in geography in modern times, because you have reams of data. You have people you can talk to. But sadly, the Romans, I mean, we are talking 2,000 years ago. We don't have a lot of... We have some data, we have some texts, but there is not a lot of information about how they thought about their landscapes, if they even thought about their landscapes. So I needed tools, and I decided, okay, I need something substantial, a good methodology that I could apply to understand and to analyze this relationship between the people and their landscapes in the past. And I went to Southampton, to the University of Southampton in England, in the UK. They had this amazing Master of Science degree, archaeological computing. I did the version in special technologies, so I learned a lot about databases, geographic information systems, 3D reconstructions. It was amazing. It was like an explosion of knowledge. So, and I have been always interested in computing and these quantitative methods. Everything fell into place. Suddenly I had the people in the past and the perspectives to the people in the past through ancient history and archaeology. I had the element of landscapes showing the relationship between the people and the areas, the hinterlands, the lands they inhabited, they transformed. And then I had the tools to explore and analyze those relationships in a very structured way. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Cool.
May I ask, how do you do landscape archaeology? You said you have ancient sources and you have like databases and maps. Mm-hmm. I guess there are maps involved somewhere.
Yes, definitely.
So how, what do you do with these things? It's like, do you reconstruct how they felt, or do you go there and say, okay, this looked different? Is this more like Assassin's Creed style? Like, do you go there and then you try to reconstruct it so you can, other people can feel it? Or is this more like you try to describe, or something completely different?
Actually, in landscape archaeology, there are many ways in which you can explore this past relationship between people and their landscapes. And there is this current of phenomenology in which you experience the landscape. And there is a lot of literature on that. However, I did like an overview to the ways in which you can use landscape. And I decided that I would rather go through the more analytical and quantitative methods way. So usually in my day-to-day work, what I do is I think of a research question. So, for example, did the Romanization, thinking about the PhD, did the Romanization of Baetica, the conquest of the southern Iberia, change the relationship that people had with their landscapes? So with this question in mind, basically I start thinking like, okay, how can I answer this? First, I need information about the landscape, and this I get from cartography. I can get digital elevation models that are representations of the topography of the areas. I can get information about the river networks. Of course, all of this cartography is showing the landscapes and these areas as they are nowadays. So we need to make some assumptions. And the main assumption is that, well, 2,000 years have passed, but we are going to assume that nothing has changed in the landscape. I know this is a big jump, but that's the data that we have. So we need to make the most of the data. Okay, so with that, we have the landscape. Then we need to put the people in the landscape. And putting the people in the landscape is looking at where they settled, where they worked, where they had their religious places, their symbolic places, what was important for them. And that's archaeology. Archaeology gives you that information. So we have reports, excavations, gazetteers giving us the information about archaeological sites and which type of archaeological sites they are, if they are settlements, which kind of settlements, if they are quarries or if they are fish processing facilities and so on. So you start putting dots in the map. You can probably imagine that this is starting to become a very complex and large data set, right?
Yes.
So this is where databases and geographic information systems come in. I really, truly believe that databases and geographic information systems, or GIS as they are also known, are very powerful tools and one and two of the best things that may have happened to classical archaeology in the last 35 years. That's probably saying a lot. But those tools allow you to organize and structure all of that information in a way that you can literally analyze all that data in one go. So databases allow you to structure all of that information, and geographic information systems allow you to visualize all of that information together and start asking questions about that those distributions. Are these points closer to rivers? Are these points in higher grounds? Are these points different? Are there settlements that are associated to ritual places? So you start asking questions, and you can answer those questions looking at the spatial relationship between them all. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Cool. Great.
A lot of sense.
Yeah, it actually makes a lot of sense, yeah. And I think I wouldn't just say it's a great addition, or maybe the greatest addition to classical archaeology, but I think we can widen this perspective a little bit, because it all touches or forms or shapes prehistoric archaeology.
Yes.
Very much. So I think...
Not only archaeology, it's also history, yeah. And I think
yes.
in adjacent fields, it's like...
I am being a little bit partisan here with mm-hmm. classical archaeology, because I am making the point all the time about classical archaeology.
Yeah.
But databases and geographic information systems have been massive. I mean, we have geographic information systems in our telephones. We use Google Maps, Google Earth indeed. All the time to navigate our current world. And that is geographic information systems in a nutshell. It's just great. It's a fantastic tool. So, indeed, so
yeah,
good.
Yeah. Let's take one half step back and look a bit more about the sources.
Okay.
Okay, landscape. Maybe we take the assumption it didn't change that much.
Yes.
So we...
Okay.
I will come back to this later, but first about the data points, the archaeological evidence. I mean, this is an evidence which is very fragmented, as we all know. How does this shape your approaches, your questions, your answers maybe? And how do you tackle this?
Oh, God. That's one of the things that make analysis and these interpretations interesting. Things look very clear and very obvious when you see them in maps, because we tend to think of maps as something that is true. But then maps are interpretations of the reality. You are choosing what information you are showing, and there is a certain process of thinking about what you are trying to transmit, the ideas you're trying to transmit. So they are tools and the result of thinking processes and so on. Archaeological data is by nature incomplete, because there are lots of processes that have erased or
changed, shaped.
Change, yes. I mean, I'm thinking of archaeological sites. If you have an archaeological site, let's say a harbor, river harbor, very close to the river, I mean, rivers change their course. So the lateral mobility, how they move across the floodplain, is going to affect the remains, the material remains of the harbor. It may either put meters and meters and meters of sediments on top of the harbor infrastructure, or if the river course is going too close to the infrastructure, it may literally destroy it, erase it bit by bit. We end up with either something that is not visible anymore or something that has been destroyed. But sometimes we are lucky and we get sources, literary sources, that say like, okay, this community that we know or this city that we know is located in this very specific place had a river port. And that river port was placed on this specific river. And so we get evidence of things that were, but are not anymore. Then we need to make educated guesses about where these places may have been. And of course, these are guesses. This is not certain knowledge. But sadly, in archaeology, these situations are more common than we would like to. We need to be aware of the limitations of the data, but also be a bit optimistic and try to work with what we have. So it's always a tension between this is what the data suggests, but the data has these limits and these problems, and I really need to take these limits into account and these problems into account when producing interpretations and literally trying to bring life back to the communities that I'm discussing. So yeah, it's tricky.
It indeed is, yeah. I was just thinking about, because this is also a little bit my PhD, because I'm trying to evaluate this question, how good, how robust is this data?
Yes.
So it's a very huge field, actually, and yes. Usually many, many times you see just researchers just using the data as is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the question swinging by, what is missing from the picture, basically?
Yes, indeed.
And, yeah.
Do you work a lot with ancient geographers, like Ptolemy or Strabo?
A little bit, yes.
A little.
I read the texts, but the thing is that the perspectives they provide are useful in a way, but sometimes it's more about what we would call anthropology and sociology. But then they also give very interesting descriptions of geographical features or geographical configurations. So that makes very interesting cases, because you literally have descriptions of places and regions that have changed a lot ever since. It warms my heart a little bit, because it's like I'm looking at this place that I can see in the maps, I can visit it now, but I'm looking at this place through the eyes of someone who was there or who read about this place from someone else. But, so it's kind of like a special connection.
And also a little bit maybe the question about scale, because they are maybe Ooh. Talking a different scale than
yes.
you or we are looking at it, no?
Yes, that's the thing. Scale. Scale is a complete world in itself. In the literary sources, we see scales mixed over and over again. So we are jumping from very large areas to very specific details, and then going into the mid-range about the relationship between two different cities or two different communities. And I like to have a more structured approach to scale at the beginning. So I tend to try and study relationships from, let's say, from all local, and then increasing the complexity or the scale until regional levels. And then I go into the relationship between the different scales, because, I mean, reality is messy. So things are always mixed. Things that we thought are separated and contained, suddenly they are not. And we need to acknowledge that messiness also in the relationship that people had with their landscapes and with each other in the past. So more complex elements, more complex factors, and more complex things to take into account in landscape archaeology, classical archaeology, and computing science.
So maybe one could also use these attributes. They are like sort of interconnected or interdependent, no?
Yes.
All these different factors. And maybe we take this as a little bridge getting to your most recent project. Well, it's called Beyond Ports, Movement and Connectivity in the Roman Mediterranean.
Uh-huh. That's correct.
Well, from the title, at least, it says that you have the port as a starting point. And
uh-huh.
In port, everyone, I think, can imagine they are used maybe as hubs for connectivity and for connecting people, connecting empires and stuff like this. But here you say you go beyond ports. So what does this mean? What is your idea behind this?
Okay, again, a bit of context about this project. Because of my work, my previous work, from my PhD, I developed one line of research that was basically exploring how people relate with their landscapes and how we identify and explore these relationships and how they change through time to see change in the people in these local communities. So that was one path. And then while I was in Southampton doing my master's in archaeological computing, I came in touch with Professor Simon Kay, who at the time, he was working very intensively in the Portus project. Portus is the maritime port of Rome. Actually, when you go down in the airport of Fiumicino, where you're going into the airport, if you are lucky and you are sat in the correct part of the plane, you can see an hexagonal body of water. That hexagonal body of water, it's an artificial basin that was excavated in Trajanic times, so at the beginning of the second century CE. And that is part of the very massive infrastructure that was the maritime port of Rome. That was an artificial harbor that was built by, well, ordered to be built by Emperor Claudius in the first century CE. And the University of Southampton had a massive project there, funded by different sources and funding bodies. And I was lucky enough to be invited to come and work in the Portus project. And then, again, I fell in love with ports and harbors and the very complex hubs that harbors are. Because it's not only the things going in and things going out, it's also the people coming in and coming out and relating to each other, and how this intermingling of people, goods, and ideas literally brings a lot of new things and a lot of new ideas up. So I started to develop a second line of research with ports and harbors. Then I was also involved in the ERC project, Rome's Mediterranean Ports project, also led by Professor Simon Kay in Southampton. So when I finished my PhD, I did my postdoc at the British School at Rome, exploring the port system of Rome. So the interconnection between Portus, Ostia, and Rome, and the role of the river and the changing character and the changing course of the river across time, and how those changing courses affected mobility and the relationship between the people and the river and the landscape in itself. So research is very fun, but it's very difficult to have two separate lines of research. I was working on both lines and I saw so many similarities, so many things that could be used from one line to the other. And then I started to think of an idea. What about if we, instead of looking at ports as nodes, we put them in the landscape, in the territory? Mm-hmm. Because ports are not isolated. They are part of a mesh, of a network of connections. So I wanted to put the harbors and the ports back into the whole system, the whole territory, the whole landscape. And that was the genesis of this Beyond Ports project. So in this project, I want to look at the role of ports and how they change the way people in the past organized their landscape, how they changed the environment. They adapted the conditions of littoral areas to make the most of the natural conditions to make it possible to connect with others beyond the sea, but also farther back in the land. So that was the idea. I think it is working very well, but then I was not accounting for how much littoral areas have changed in the last 2,000 years. And then I realized that to do a proper job of this, I really needed to add these transformations of the coastal areas into the mix. So it is not only the landscape, and it is not only how past communities lived in the landscape and transformed the landscape. It's also looking at these natural processes that have transformed the coastal areas and littoral areas, processes of sedimentation, of erosion, of vertical displacement. Again, this makes it very complex, but this is also a very important factor that we really need to take into account when thinking of harbors and their wider role and how they connect with other places and so on.
No, I'm very curious. Which place or which harbor has changed the most in the sense of natural sedimentation or like vertical displacement or something like this? Is there one where you're like, oh, I can't believe there was a harbor there because now there's like deep sea or something like this, or a big mountain there?
Have you thought about this topic, about this question before?
I do a lot of work in Crete, like shifted around. One side lifted up like, I think, 12 meters and the other side went down 12 meters.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah, but you didn't see this if you're there. It's like, you think it was always like this.
Exactly. The thing is that we go through the landscape, we visit places, we go to archaeological sites, and this is like, oh, of course, this is exactly as it was 2,000 years ago. We can see the things that people saw in the past and da-da-da-da-da. But this is not true. Things change a lot. And I was not ready for how much landscapes change. So in this project, I'm working on two different areas. One is the south part of the Iberian Peninsula, so basically the coast of Baetica. And the second case study is Western Turkey, so Western Anatolia, Western Asia Minor. The changes, I mean, the moment you start scratching the surface, you see so many amazing examples. For example, are you familiar with the town of Miletus, the city of Miletus?
Yeah, it's in central Turkey, on the west coast.
Yeah. So the thing is that if you look at literary sources, Miletus in the archaic period is a very powerful maritime power. Well, you know what I mean. They have colonies. They have very important relationships. They were a very important regional player and beyond. Cool. If you look at the map where Miletus is, it's around 5-7 kilometers from the sea. Okay. How is this even possible? This doesn't make any sense. How is it possible that Miletus was a maritime power, such an important maritime power, if it's literally in the middle of the land? Well, that's changes in the landscape, in literal landscape for you. There is a very important river very close by, and we are very lucky that the Germans did a massive research project in this river valley. And they did a lot of coring and geoarchaeological studies. So coring, in geoarchaeology, there are many ways in which you can study the development of landscapes. But one of the main ones is literally extracting columns of sediments from the soil. And then you analyze those sediments. From those analyses, you can infer the environmental characteristics of this specific point in space through time, because you also can date it using absolute methods of the dating and so on, like, such as radiocarbon dating and so on. So you get pictures, snapshots of how this specific point in space was at different periods of different moments in time. And if you do those corings across the whole valley, you can see how the valley developed in the last 5,000 years. And thanks to this very massive study, we know that what we see now, that is a fully terrestrial river valley, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, was an estuary that has been progressively infilled with the sediments of this river. This means that by the time that we know Miletus was a very powerful maritime entity, power, community, actually they were in the sea.
This is quite a change.
Yes, exactly. And the funny thing is that we have examples of this all over the Mediterranean. The moment you start looking at these kind of processes, it's happening everywhere. Your mind explodes with the potential. Then the other thing that you can do is if you go into Google Earth and you start looking at satellite imagery, sometimes you can actually see harbor infrastructure, Roman and Hellenistic harbor infrastructure in the sea. So you can see it underwater. The thing in Turkey is that because of tectonic dynamics, the plaque where Turkey is sinking, slowly sinking. So the harbor infrastructure that was active and above water in Roman times, now it's sunk. It has sunk a few meters, but you still can see it in satellite images. So again, that's another element of minds exploding, like mine. This project has been really fun in this sense.
If I may add just a little other example from the Atlantic, the site of Boca do Rio Veo. So I've been working some time. Here you have actually both processes, because from the south, the Atlantic is basically eating the site. So we have a lot of erosion, coastal erosion. But in Roman times, you had also an estuary with an inland harbor and possibly also an outer one, which is not existent anymore because of the erosion. But the estuary now is completely sedimented, so it's dry land. You don't see anything. So you have both things. Very good conservation in the inside because everything is just filled up. But you don't see, you don't recognize it. And in the south, it's just basically missing. It's just not there.
So it's not there anymore.
Yeah. And this on a very small scale, it's just like a couple of hundred meters, but both processes happening over millennia.
Yeah.
These formation processes, it's a very interesting thing because it took a long time to get into our research lines. No, I think the first formal studies about this were from the late 80s, beginning of the 90s with Michael Schiffer, formation processes. Mm-hmm. But he's just basically listing all the different factors which might happen. But from this point until actually using this in the research, it still took a lot of time, or at some points even is still taking time and effort to implement this.
Yeah, the thing is that, I mean, we work in archaeology, and then we have very good relationships with ancient historians. And then we have very good relationship with epigraphists. But this geoarchaeology and these computer methods, these are disciplines that we are very foreign, to us. So it takes a while to get to understand them and to establish conversations with people, because these are different vocabularies. These are different ideas, different methods. And you need to get to understand each other to have like a fruitful conversation and move things forward. So this takes time and patience. But I think in the interdisciplinarity, this is the key to addressing, I mean, not only harbors, I'm focusing on harbors in this project and so on. But in looking at the same problem from different perspectives, this has so much potential to solve so many problems. I mean, conversations, collaboration. This is what we need. Well, not only in archaeology, anywhere, everywhere.
Yeah, because one cannot cover all these topics.
Of course not.
From a time basis, but also based on your own training, no?
Yeah, exactly.
I can't answer these geological questions. Mm-hmm. I might be able to think about them, but I can't answer them.
Yeah.
Before, when we were talking about entering this project, we were talking about the ports and their surroundings and the peoples beyond the ports.
Uh-huh.
But what is in the in-between? So the sea, basically, or the river, maybe. How do you cover these large areas, which you have the port at the coast, and 50% is land and 50% is sea? How do you address the sea?
Short answer, in a very theoretical way. When I was writing the proposal for this project, I was super ambitious and super optimistic with the data and the time available. I thought like, oh, 4 years? That's a lot of time. I can do this, no problem. So my plan was trying to put together the connectivity in the land and also the connectivity in the sea. Problem was that then reality hit like a train. Then I realized that actually maritime connectivity is very complex, because if you think modeling the movement over land in GIS, it's difficult. Oh my dear, do I have news for you if you are trying to do this on the sea. So then I was also not expecting the transformations of the littoral areas as massive and as enticing and as complex as they really became. So slowly, slowly, the maritime connectivity was progressively pushed a bit further down the line. And I'm afraid so far it's still more a concept than a reality. But good news about this is that, I mean, obviously I am not the only one, I'm the only researcher thinking about these topics. There is a lot going on in these topics in academia in general, mostly in the last 15 years. There has been a real explosion of interest on these topics. And there has been a lot of work by very smart people and very smart researchers that have been thinking very hard about how to model this navigation, how to take into account these maritime connections. I was invited to a workshop in the German Archaeological Institute in Madrid 3 weeks ago, I think it was. And we had very interesting conversations and very interesting insights about how to model these maritime connections using computers and dynamic data and so on. So I am very excited to say that even though I have been focusing on the land, there is a lot of work that is going on in the sea, and that connections and conversations between the two sites are possible and under development. I mean, I don't need to do everything. This is a community of people thinking of the past. So it's good that we are doing different things, and then we talk and then we engage and we compare our results and we make connections.
If I was a sailor in antiquity, and I was from Rome, and I would go around the Mediterranean, I have no idea where I would go, because I have no idea where they were shipping, maybe to Alexandria. How would my landscape look like? Is it like the ports? Is it my home city? Am I mostly there and then only traveling far away, come back? And or is it the coastal regions? I have no idea. I'm trying to imagine what would be my landscape as a sailor.
Cool. I think I have an idea. Okay. Think of nowadays. You are a taxi driver, right? So usually taxi drivers work in a city, and in some occasions they go farther than the city and they connect to nearby villages, or so that's, let's say, a scale of interaction within the region at a very local or super local scale of movement. But then you have lorry drivers. They can connect, or they drive from one port or to very different cities, because they are basically transporting goods across a line of supply or moving things around. And this may happen in a very specific region, the very specific area, I don't know, in the southwestern Portugal, let's say. Or they can connect the port of Rotterdam with Frankfurt, let's say. So here you have different scales of movement. Maritime, in antiquity, we can think along those same lines. So there were people, there were sailors that were specialized on very specific areas. For example, fishermen. In one day you go around, you go and return. Then there are people, sailors, that have their own boats and they connect secondary ports, or they go to the main port, they get some exotic goods, and then in their way back they stop in all of the ports that they find and they do a little bit of transactions here, a little bit of transactions there. So you sell something, you buy something back, and you just basically move around the region. And then you have very specialized sailors that are crossing the borders, let's say. So they are going from Rhodes to Alexandria, or they are going from Gades to Rome, or they are going from Tarraco to Narbo Martius. They are going from so many places. So basically they are doing long distance trade. And all of these different levels of movement require very specific knowledge and skills that you learn in your life. And then you become specialized in these routes and you do them over and over again. And that is your basic your life. You become familiar with the landmarks that allow you to understand where you are. You get to know the places where you can go if suddenly there is a storm, where you can take refuge. This is knowledge that they acquire through engaging with their landscapes, through learning from the mentors, the people they work with. So that is something that is not very clear, that we don't see in literary sources, or definitely not in archaeology. But we know this is the way. I mean, we have plenty of examples across sociology and anthropology, even literature. So this actually makes a lot of sense. The problem is trying to translate that knowledge and that agency of the pilot into something that can be modeled in a computer. That's the struggle, and that is where we are, well, we as a collective, we are working towards.
Thank you for this very human perspective which we are just bringing to this discussion. Sadly, I have to announce that we are reaching about our usual time limit, because I really have a lot of questions more, both here on my cheat sheet and in my head based on the discussion. Maybe we just ask ourselves very quickly, where do you think this field develops into in the next couple of years? Talking, maybe we can add the sea as another field of study also, which might serve as a proper basis. But where do you see the next steps?
I think the general direction is establishing more connections between the different fields and the different people that are working in these topics and these questions. And I am very excited about that. I find that classical archaeology in particular is a very individualistic affair. So we work on our topic and we stay in our topic, and we barely know what the person in the office next door is doing. But I see changes, and I see changes in the way of people getting to know what the neighbor is doing, what other people in other universities or research institutions are doing. It warms my heart to see that we are taking the effort of trying to understand what other people are doing and what can come from collaborations across very different disciplines and very different ideas and very different backgrounds. I guess that's also kind of, I mean, I have a very diverse background, and I truly believe that looking at problems from different perspectives, this is actually the way forward, to propose solutions, to do experiments, to try and to make things better. And this is not only for archaeology or classical archaeology, this is for everything. So I'm very excited about this movement towards collaboration and conversations, discussions, and so on. And I want to think that this is going to not only happen in classical archaeology, this is going to happen in more widely in the humanities, and hopefully across society. We really need that.
Very nice final remarks. Marika, thank you for sharing your work. Thank you for being here. It was a pleasure having you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. I have really enjoyed this.
Yes, and thank you for telling us all these interesting stuff. This research. That's the word I was looking for.
I do understand that this is a lot to process. That there is a lot to unpack here. I'm very happy that you survived the experience. You two here and you two people listening. I know it's a lot.
Unseren Zuhörern, vielen Dank, dass ihr wieder dabei wart heute. Wie gehabt, stellen wir weitere Informationen und Bilder auch über die Shownotes zur Verfügung. Und wir hören uns dann beim nächsten Mal wieder auf den Spuren alter Kulturen.